Thanks, Eileen. Thank you very much.
It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Wash your hands.
Good afternoon on this Wednesday afternoon. How are you? 51551 for your text. You can send us emails to ray@rte.ie. I love how tiny the world is. I was on a Zoom call this morning for the Kildare Local Sports Partnership. And sports partnerships are in counties all over the country and they do amazing work in promoting sport. Anyway, I was on a Zoom call and Eddie Hennessy works on the Kildare Sports Partnership. Eddie's from Athy. And then I come in to the next Zoom call, which is a meeting for today's show. And somebody says, "Do you see, picture this. Picture this. They're on the Late Late Show with James Corden in America." And I go, "Sure, wasn't I talking to Ryan's dad this morning on a Zoom call? Ryan Hennessy from Athy, Eddie's son, is the lead singer with Picture This, appearing on that big chat show in America." It's tiny. The world's tiny. The world's tiny. I was listening to the debate about the pool bag chimneys in Dublin. And the Journal have done a poll to see how many people want to see them stay and how many people want to see them go. Should they stay or should they go? To use the Clash. Well, to stay, 4,508, which is 65%. And no, 1,886, which is 27%. And then 513 said, "Not sure, no opinion." I'm always perplexed by people who go on and vote on those things and say, "Not sure, no opinion." Because it takes an effort. Like, you either want them or you don't want them. And then you log on, you vote, and you go, "Not sure, not sure. I know I'm here. Maybe I knew 2 minutes ago, but I don't know now. I'm not sure." Anyways, back in the 70s, as a 10-year-old, I was in St. Vincent's Hospital. I wasn't that sick. I had a rash. And I remember being on the fourth floor and looking out the window, and the pool bag chimneys had just been built in the early 70s. And they were a thing to behold, particularly for a 10-year-old boy up from Kildare. And they were bright and shiny and red and white and blah. Now, mind you, there was smoke billowing out of them. And I thought, see, I'm completely wrong on this, and you might offer your opinion on it, but I thought that once they were decommissioned, that the memories that people would have of them is of these things, chimneys billowing out smoke, a different time when we were less conscious of the harm we were doing to the planet, and that maybe we might want to get rid of them. You know, but no, people see them as iconic. That's a word a lady used on the news last night. People see them as being an integral part of the Dublin skyline. I don't get it. I don't get it. But that's just me. And what's 27% of the people who voted on that? 1,886 people. But the majority of people. And they're going to have to encase it in fiberglass or something. And then that's going to take away from the aesthetic, if there is an aesthetic with two chimneys, but there is. That's interesting there. Ray@rte.ie was busy overnight. Neil was on. He says, "Can your listeners help? We brought home our lovely newborn daughter on Tuesday. All went well. Delighted. No name yet. She's gorgeous. But the name is not the problem. She has an older brother, our firstborn. He is 2 years old and he's not taking it well. He's in shock, I think. Very quiet, very jealous, and a lot of tantrums. Hopefully it's just a little phase. But any advice to speed up this phase, please? Thanks," says Neil. Well, they suggest and advise that you get a present from the newborn to give to the older brother or sister. So they associate them with nice things. It's sort of a bribe, but they don't know that because they're only two. And they think, "Oh yeah, there's a little present. Oh, this is a nice thing." But I've heard horrific stories. Like, I remember hearing a story of parents returning to a kitchen to find a three-year-old with a baby, holding the baby over a bin, about to deposit the newborn baby into the bin because they were discombobulated so much by this interloper that they said, "Out, get out, rubbish, get out." It's a difficult one and people have been through it. So if you have any advice for Neil, and congratulations, Neil, congratulations on your newborn. On your newborn daughter, no name attached yet. I don't, you see, people do that, don't they? They go, "Oh, we can't choose a name until we see them." So they bring them home, they look at the baby intently and they go, "Doesn't look like an Anne. Looks more like a Grace. Does it look like a race to you? Maybe an Eve. Aoife. Maybe it looks like an Aoife. That's the way some people do it. I kid you not. Others, of course, go through the book of names beforehand, and they have, you know, a name for a boy, a name for a girl, if they haven't found out the gender of the baby. And then they, once it's born, you're a Jack, or you're a Grace, or you're a Rose, or you're a Daniel, or whatever you are. Anyway, advice for Neil, 51551 or ray@rte.ie. James has been on from Cork, and his name is Douglas, which is a coincidence because there is a Douglas in Cork. He said, just to say, please, please, please help all of your fellow countrymen and women refer to the UK monarchy in the correct way and stop referring to them as English or calling the monarch the Queen of England. I know you know, and all the rest must know, that the Queen is Queen of the United Kingdom, not just England. In fact, there would hardly be any monarchy since the 1600s if the King of Scotland had not become also the King of England with the union of the crowns, thus forming the, you guessed it, United Kingdom. In fact, there is very little English blood in the UK monarch. Most of the Queen's British blood is actually Scots, given the late Queen Mother was Scottish. But Diana and Kate Middleton may even... They may even the balance in coming generations. Anyway, just an observation, but the Irish are generally quite remiss with acknowledging that your nearest neighbours are not just the English, but the Welsh and the Scots too. Please note on many occasions when saying English, when you really should say British, and not just when it comes to the rugby, says James in Douglas. Sorry, James Douglas in Cork, not in Douglas. We don't know exactly where in Cork he is, but a Scot who lives in London much of the time. Right, that's very complicated. And then we're accused, James, of saying the Queen, because people go, well, we don't have a Queen, so the Queen of who? So then we should say the Queen of the United Kingdom. The fallout continues. Piers Morgan is gone. There's rumours going around that he's already secured a job in this new news network. I think it's called News GB. Because I got these pangs of guilt last night because I accused him of being an actor and that he stormed off set, you know, that it was a big setup, sort of pantomime-like. And I got, oh, maybe, and then when he lost his job, I said, oh, poor Piers, he's lost his job. And then I discovered that it looks like, now these are just rumours, that he has a job secured already. And now everybody's talking about him. And what better way to launch your new career on a new network than to do what he has just done? And that's the type of person he is. That's the type of plans he makes. We were talking yesterday to a man called Richard Greenwood, and he was telling us about a meteorite that was found in a driveway in the UK. And he was telling us that the rock was 4.2 billion years old. And I was saying to myself, it's difficult to get your head around that sort of time frame. And Mike Curley was on overnight to assist me in that. He says, one way of visualising millions versus billions is this. A million seconds is 12 days, right? A million seconds is 12 days. A billion seconds is 31 years. My head's going to explode. And that's from Mike Curley, heading for 2 billion seconds old. So a billion seconds is 31 years. That's a nice little bit of information now to take away with you and entertain your friends, family, children, grandchildren, whoever you might meet along the way. Thanks for that, Mike. Chimneys, on the chimneys. Ray, get rid of those pool bag chimneys. They're hideous. Bring back the pillar, says John in Phibsborough. We don't expect Colchis to get it. Ah, I see. That's why I don't get it. I've no problem with spending millions of euro to preserve redundant chimneys that are beyond their design life, but I don't want to pay for it through my electricity bill. If people in Dublin City want to send money to the chimney, let them pay it through their property taxes, says John Mulligan. Save the chimneys! Save the chimneys! I would love to see the chimneys being kept, but definitely not at the cost that they're quoting. It's millions, isn't it? Cost should have been included in the poll, Jerry Glasnevin, and I can see them from my house. See, we used to be able to see them from our window, our kitchen window, and then the neighbours built on. Can't see them anymore. So maybe that's it. My surname is Power. My two daughters are called Flower and Horse. As in Flower Power and Horse Power. Only kidding. They're called Roisin and Emer. Good Irish names. Simon here in Wakelaw. How are you doing, Simon? I went online to buy a piece of meteorite for my love, but the prices are astronomical. Hey! See, that's the way to start the day. A good old pun. And if you're going online to buy the chairs that Harry and Meghan sat in while being interviewed by Oprah Winfrey, in the garden of her friend's house. You'd be disappointed because they're sold out. Yeah. Seemingly, people were clamouring over themselves to get their hands on the Christopher Knight Home Birchett outdoor club chairs, which retail at just under $554. That's €465 for a pair. So that's what? $232.50 each. The chairs are made of acacia wood with plastic rattan sides and are from US designer Christopher Knight. And he's happy that they were featured on that. And I'm sure they're frantically trying to get more made so they can cash in on the fallout from the interview. Good news from the Darcy house. My mother got her first vaccine this morning. Yay! Which is great news. And she was delighted with herself and over the moon. So that's good. And that's happening all over the country. Patrick Lee has been on to us. He sent us in his book, Streets Paved with Hope. It's a memoir. And he says, I had the privilege of having one of my stories included in a page from my life. And this inspired and encouraged me to complete my memoir during lockdown. Enclosed is a copy of this book, Streets Paved with Hope, which I have just published. I think you'll enjoy it and would welcome any feedback. I can be contacted on phone, blah, blah, blah. Patrick Lee. Congratulations, Patrick. What a brilliant achievement. And we're delighted to be part of the book in that, you know, getting your story into a page of my life was the encouragement that you needed to write your memoir. So congratulations on that. Streets Paved with Hope, Patrick Lee. Now, yeah, we have to tell them about our quiz of today. And I can't find the details of the quiz for today, but I can tell you that we've cobbled together 10 questions on the 10th of March. Big events, scientific breakthroughs and all that from over the years. I'm looking for two people. Two people. Thank you very much, David. We're looking for two people to come on and answer 5 questions each. And I think you might be enthusiastic about getting on today because we have a great prize. Courtesy of Electric Ireland, who are launching their new smart meter price plans, helping you manage your electricity usage for the better. That means no more estimated bills or submitting your meter readings. You can search Electric Ireland smart meters to find out more about smart meters and the benefits. And thanks to Electric Ireland, for the person who wins our quiz of today, they will get a brand new 50-inch HD smart TV. That's a nice prize. The first step on your way to winning that prize is to answer our qualifying question, which is this. In which Irish county would you find the town of Clonmel? In which Irish county would you find the town of Clonmel? 1850 715900. That's 1850 715900. Thank you very much. A few more in on the chimneys there. My sons named those chimneys Nana's Pipes in the 1980s as we drove across to visit their Nana. Leave them where they are, says Barbara. Barbara, I just have an opinion. I've no influence. Why not turn the two Dublin chimneys into wind turbines? They can negate the damage they did to the environment in the past. I'd say they're too close together now to be separate wind turbines. There was a talk of putting a big bubble out of the stacks on the hour to attract tourists to Dublin. I'd love to see that. Be a great laugh. There was somebody else was saying, I think David was saying that there was plans at one stage to build a bridge between the two of them. That would be a viewing platform that people would climb up to the top and be able to get that lovely view over Dublin and out to the Dublin Mountains and the Wicklow Mountains, and that was suggested as well. But at the moment, it's going to cost millions to maintain and more millions if they have to encase it in fibreglass or some sort of concrete, and that would take away from the original look. So do people want it that way? Anyway, keep your comments coming in and your views and your opinions, 51551 or ray@rte.ie. Good afternoon. No on the Whale. And 5 years later, or even 5 years' time. 51551 or ray@rte.ie. One of the nicest sights, says Jackie, when returning from abroad and flying into Dublin Airport, is seeing the chimneys. It feels like you're home safely, whether a Dub or a Coochie. And I have so many memories of those chimneys. I saw them from my bedroom when I lived in Rathmines, and then when I was older, bringing my dad to the boat to go and visit his sister in England. Definitely, we have to keep them. Take care. Glad your mum got the vaccine. I'm waiting for mine. That's Patrice. Thanks, Patrice. And the chimneys, I have a compromise. Knock one down and make a flagpole from the other with a huge Irish flag that could be seen from Knockananna. That's Tom. You see, we should repurpose them. I like that. We start with Tom's suggestion there. Knock one down, use the other as a flagpole. So how would you repurpose the chimneys out in Poolbeg? It would only cost £1 to sort the two chimneys, £1 of plastic explosive. Ba-dum-tsh. Stretch a huge gallibander between them. Oh, yeah, sorry. A big elastic band. Yeah. And shoot huge folded paper ammo at whatever's in range. I like that. That's great. This is good suggestions. Good suggestions. What else? You have to look at how Dubliners have embraced these chimneys. When the Stephen's Green Art Market is back, go there to see the vast array of paintings of the chimneys. They're now as iconic as the Halfpenny Bridge, says Maura. And Elaine Fallon has been on to us from Brookwood Pottery. She says, I'm in the studio packing up orders of my Ring's End vases, which are my best seller. I hope they don't knock them down. As I say, these are my best seller. So they're vases inspired by the chimneys, you see. So, and a lot of artwork is inspired by the chimney. And like, I would imagine if you are a budding artist, that the chimneys are easy enough to do. And they have a bit of colour to them, and you're probably going to get the beach in the foreground and the blue sky in the background, and then you have the red and the white. So I can see why people gravitate towards them to paint. It makes complete sense. Now, 51551, Ray at RTE.ie.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray at RTE.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Flying in, Carmen has been on and said there is such a thing as urban beauty, where industrial structures can become part of a city's identity. In Dublin, these might be the particular lamppost designs, one example of which are along the Clontarf waterfront, or the lighthouses of Dublin, or the bridges along the Liffey, such as the Halfpenny Bridge or Samuel Beckett Bridges, or indeed the Pigeon House chimneys. They are part of the cityscape and so part of us, and as such should be valued, says Carmen. I was out at the chimneys last night watching the trawlers come into the quays. They should be left well alone, says Leisha. Okay. Sports file photographer Steve McCarthy should have been snapping pictures of elite athletes competing in the Olympics and the Euros last year, but instead he travelled to 87-year-old Pat Nocton's house in Neenah to capture him training in his sitting room. The photo, which is called Home Training, has earned him a short listing or a win at the World Press Photos in the prestigious sports singles category. And Steve McCarthy's on the line now. How are you doing, Stephen?
I'm very good, Raina. And yourself?
Good. Congratulations.
Thanks very much. We're over the moon with the news.
So you know you're in the top three. You don't know whether you got gold, silver or bronze. Is that it?
Yeah, that's the way it is. So I suppose I'm fortunate enough. I've been down this road before a couple of years ago. And even though it is for second or third, you know, something you can't even remember where you came the last time. At the end of the day, it's a World Press Photo Award. Whether it's first, second or third, I'm happy. I'm right. Absolutely over the moon with it.
Give our listeners an idea of how big this competition is.
Oh, this is massive. Like, especially as a sports photographer. Like, this is probably the pinnacle of our career to be able to win one of these awards. You're dealing with every press photographer in the world here. Every year, everybody enters it. So maybe if you're a news photographer, you may have a chance of winning a Pulitzer Prize or something like that. We probably believe sport is probably the most important thing in the world, but at the end of the day, maybe we're a bit biased and sport will not win a Pulitzer Prize, I'd say, anytime soon. So for us, when we go out every day, this is what we're thinking about. This is what we're always dreaming about, is winning one of these awards.
Okay. This is not your typical sports photograph, Stephen. Describe it to our listeners.
No, it's not. It's not. Like, and as you said in the intro there, like, last year in 2020, like, it was meant to be the four games in Dublin and the Euros, the Olympic Games, all these amazing things to look forward to. It's going to be such a busy year. And instead, as you said, we found myself in the living room of Pat Nocton's house in Neenah in County Tipperary. So Pat is a master's athlete. So he competes every year in the national championships. That's his big one. And he's even travels abroad to compete and all that. But Pat will compete in the long jump, the high jump, the sprint, everything you can think of, Pat competes in it. But Pat's training didn't stop even in the during the pandemic, so he had to keep going. So when the marking came across our desk, the story originated from Cathal Denny, who's a journalist, was writing a piece for Irish Independent, and it came across our desk to say, look, this might actually suit for some pictures. So I thought to myself, this has to be good. Like, just, I didn't have much of a background, but I knew it said 87-year-old Pat Nocton training at his home. I said, this is going to be good, whatever happens.
Okay.
But even when I got down there, it was beyond my wildest dreams what we got. So Pat was practicing his sprints. So we arranged to meet that I would be there when he was doing his training in the morning. So he trains for 15 minutes in the morning and then he again trains in the afternoon. So in the, I said, I would photograph what happens in the morning. So Pat, you start at one end of the corridor, run all the way up through the corridor, into the living room, all the doors are left open, into the living room, around the coffee table and out the other door and into the kitchen. And that was his sprint.
In his bungalow, so in Nina.
In his bungalow, yeah. He was lucky now it was a bungalow, it wasn't a two-story house, he wouldn't have had the distance. But it was, so this is what Pat done, and then he'd go along, he'd finish his sprints and he'd go and he'd practice the high jump and he'd practice the javelin and the shot put and everything inside in the living room. So it was fantastic just to see how this pandemic was not going to get in Pat's way to be ready for when the championships were back again. Now, unfortunately, the national championships didn't take place in 2020, but if there's one in 2021, he'll still be ready for it.
So I'm looking at the picture here, 87-year-old Pat. How are you doing, Pat, if you're listening? So he's in full flight, and to his right, as I'm looking at it, is the fireplace and the mirror over the fireplace, as is the same in many living rooms in Ireland. As you say, the coffee table then, he's just about to round, take a bend around the coffee table. I can see the TV there. Nice, I'd say it's about a 40-inch TV. The back of a couple of armchairs. And then, and I suppose this is what caught the judges. I don't know, but I'm thinking that there is Pat as a younger man in a photograph over the TV on the wall. What's he doing in that? I can't, because it's a bit small there for me. Is he sprinting or what's he doing?
This is him. This is Pat sprinting along the track in his younger days, I suppose. And that took pride of place, that picture, because I remember the joy in his face when himself and his wife, Joan, were showing me this picture and telling me all about it. And it's almost blown up the size of the television. That's how much pride they have in it.
Yeah, yeah.
But a couple of other things to note in the picture as well. Pat is running in his bare feet as well.
Yes,
running across.
Yeah.
So, to get a proper feel for it. And then you see the medals hanging in the background as well. The medals that he would have won over the years. And then there's also all his grandchildren, his children. And I suppose every proud parent or grandparent, they had their children's pictures hanging in around the house and in the living room. So I suppose all these things come together. And every time I look at it, I find something different or I see something new in the picture.
The brilliant thing about it is, you see, you don't normally see an 87-year-old man running around the living room. You don't normally see anybody run around a living room in a photograph. And that's, so it's immediately arresting, the photograph is. It immediately pulls you in.
Yeah, he's an inspiration. At 87 to maintain that level of fitness. We might want to go for a 5 or 10 minute walk, but every day Pat gets up and goes for his run and gets his training in.
A big difference between that one and the one that won you an award the last time in 2018, which was what?
Yeah, very, very big difference. So that picture was entitled "Steaming Scrum." So that was a picture of. It was during the British and Irish Lions tour in 2017 tour, and so that was a 6-week tour in New Zealand. And every 3 or 4 days, we'd move on to the next town, next city, photographing the Lions in our preparation for the games and the games. So this picture was taken in during a midweek game between the British and Irish Lions and the New Zealand, the Maori All Blacks. So often when people see it all as the Lions and the All Blacks, well, it's actually not. It's the Maori All Blacks. So it was a Wednesday night, a very cold, wet Wednesday night in Rotorua. And the two packs engaged in the scrum. And off of this came the body heat produced the steam that rose from it. So that was back in 2018, that was recognised in the same competition in the same category.
Okay. And when will you know where you've been placed? First, second or third?
So it's April. April now is before we hear the results of first, second and third. I think it's the 15th of April. So in the last time round, we were fortunate enough to go to Amsterdam to the awards ceremony, meet the royal family from the Dutch royal family that were there who were patrons of the competition. And it was an amazing experience because not alone have you got the awards, you've got a festival and you got the exhibition in the middle of Amsterdam. So it was fantastic. Unfortunately, there'll be none of that this year. But you know what? We're just absolutely delighted to have won the award.
Now, we were speaking to James Crombie last week, who took that amazing picture of the murmuration, which featured in all the newspapers. He's from InPhoto and you're from Sportsfile. And there's a nice bit of healthy competition between the two agencies, is there?
There is. But you know something, I think it's very important. They're two fantastic agencies.
Yeah.
But we actually push each other so much that, like, that keeps the standard so high. And we've often said, like, the standard of sports photography
in this country
probably one of the highest in is probably one of the highest in the world, like, because we have that level of competition and you're dealing with the very best every day. So you know, if you have an off day, that there's somebody sitting alongside you or around or near you that's gonna turn you over and have the page one or the back page or whatever it is. So that's what it's a healthy okay. relationship, rivalry.
Stephen, listen, congratulations again and good luck in April when the final result will be announced. And if you're talking to Pat, pass on our best wishes to him. He looks amazing.
I will, of course. I happened to be talking to him earlier on, and he and his wife told me that they got their first vaccine on Friday.
Oh, brilliant. Brilliant. Thanks. See you, Stephen. Bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Text 51551. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Mm-hmm. And the texts are stacking up in our chimney debate. When my dad was sick, he spent a lot of time in Blackrock Clinic. And when he was well enough, he used to bring his visitors up to the day room on the top floor to admire the view, including the chimneys. He died in 2011. So whenever I see them from various points around the city, they remind me of him, says Sean in Dublin. And as a man who lived overseas for years, when travelling home to Ireland, either by air or sea, the first sight of Ireland were the chimneys. It was like a welcome home sign to spot the chimneys on the horizon, says John in Galway. And I served my apprenticeship, says Damien, at Poolbeg in the 1970s. The second one was built during that time and I got a chance to stand at the top. I say keep them and repurpose, as you said, restaurant up high between both and a walkway up higher. Please tell listeners they're not pigeon house chimneys, they're pool beg. The pigeon house are and its chimneys are long gone. Aha, there's a mistake I would have made over the years, Damien. I would have called them the pigeon house chimneys, or the pool beg chimneys. Knock down the chimneys and move the spire there. Much better sight, says Ian. And pilots use those chimneys as a marker for Dublin. Could they be rebuilt as Dublin City viewing towers, visitor centre, etc.? Asked Liz in Dublin. Fix a giant wheel between them to rival London Eye. Easily done. Where there's a wheel, there's a way. Now, where's my mug? Says you. You don't do better than that to you to get a mug. Just a suggestion regarding the pigeon house. You see, there's pigeon house chimneys. Can I suggest a spiral staircase ascending at the exterior of one of the chimneys to the top, where there's a bridge constructed between both chimneys with a viewing point to view the city and Irish Sea between both chimneys, and then across to the second chimney and descend a spiral staircase to the bottom? Could be paid for by a title name from a major sponsor similar to the Aviva Stadium or the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre. This is an iconic structure on the Dublin and coastal skyline where a visitor centre could be housed. That's my tuppence word, says Martin. Thanks for that, Martin. Now, The Teenager's Book of Life is the new book by Tony Griffin. Now, you'll know Tony's name because he was a Clare hurler and an all-star. And he's one of the founders of the SOAR Foundation in Ireland, and he's on the line now. How are you doing, Tony?
How are you, Ray?
Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Congratulations on the book.
Thanks.
Now, I've read it, but it's obviously not for me.
Oh, really? Okay.
No, but I mean, it's not for me. You didn't write it for a 56-year-old man, did you?
Not when I set out, no.
No,
I definitely wrote it for teenagers when I set out, but surprisingly, 56-year-old men and women seem to be enjoying it as much as some teenagers, which is great.
Yeah. Let's get your story first, because it'll put the book in context. So you're a Clare hurler, and your dad died when?
Daddy died in 2005. He was in buildings all his life and died from asbestosis in the end. Very, very fit, 67-year-old. He would definitely have sprinted up and down the house up until very close to his death.
Yeah.
And it was a lovely, lovely man, Ray. And there was seven of us. And growing up, hurling was probably my way to stand out. And as a teenager, it was idyllic, really, you know, playing hurling and getting to play for Clare. And that gave him huge pride. And one of the last times I saw him was in Croke Park when he came very ill. And we got him a special seat so he could, if he needed to move quickly, he could. But I didn't get to see him pass. That was one of the greatest, I suppose, regrets.
You weren't in the country, were you not?
No, I for 4 years, people will think this crazy. They usually do. But at the time, it was... my father used to say a boy in love feels no cold. But a boy in love with hurling definitely doesn't feel any cold, because I used to commute from Nova Scotia, where I decided to go to university, back to Ireland every 3 weeks to play for Clare, and did that for 4 years, but just left it too late.
That's a lot of air miles, isn't it, Tony?
That's a lot of air miles on a Friday when you're playing on a Sunday. But, you know, I'd been playing for Clare for 2-3 years, and I just felt I needed to... See, I was very lucky as a teenager. I met a guy, a Canadian doctor, who worked with the team, and he kind of pulled me aside once in a way and said, "What's your dream?" And no one had ever said that to me. And he said, "Look, I think you're underachieving. You need to dream bigger." And I ended up going to the university that he'd gone to and going back as a 21-year-old to college, and started a whole new life. But that meant coming back regularly to play for Clare.
Okay.
But one of those times didn't get back in time.
Right. And that's something, obviously, that stays with you.
I'm at peace now, but it did at the time sent me to a dark place in the years after that he passed.
Yeah, and then, as you know, people channel grief in different ways. And you decided to cycle across Canada. That was your channeling of it.
I know, mad, isn't it?
Yeah.
It happened very coincidentally. Well, I heard about a fellow called Terry Fox, who some listeners will know of. Yeah. And Terry ran across Canada. He made it nearly halfway across, and he had cancer. So he ran it on one leg and a prosthetic leg. So every night he'd have to stop and bandage the wound that was bleeding and start again. But the cancer got worse and he died. And I saw a documentary and I said, I'm going to try and raise some money. So yeah, gave up hurling for a year and cycled. It was a year after I won the All-Star, so it wasn't very popular in some areas. But it was really, looking back, I just was trying to make my father proud, I think, as strange as that may sound. And it was an epic adventure when I look back, 7,000 kilometres and, you know, raised over $1 million for cancer services and care.
And you'd love a lot of time to think while you're in the saddle.
Almost too much.
Yeah.
There were some days, like, I brought three real characters with me. Like, when I asked them, the thing they said was, "How many girls will we meet along the way?" And I said, "I don't know." But they came for that reason. So they were great support. You know, they made the meals, they did some of the media, they helped. But very often for 6-7 hours in the Rockies, or particularly in the prairies, Ray, the prairies were just... You know, there's a saying, you can watch your dog run away for 5 days in the prairies. And I realised why. It was so lonely at times. But I talked to him, you know. I talked to cattle, I talked to whatever. And I definitely made some sense of things on those long days on my own.
Of your grief. And then it's like documentaries have shaped your life in a way, because you saw the Jim Stein documentary, which I've often talked about, which was a brilliantly made... Well, the subject matter was brilliant in the first place. And that inspired you to set up the SOAR Foundation.
Yeah, I come back from... I suppose in a very important part of making sense of why I decided to write the book was after the cycle, I was physically and mentally exhausted, and I thought it was bulletproof, but I didn't see coming what came next. And that was, I had a breakdown.
Right.
And, you know, it just sent me into a kind of a 18-month, almost 2 years.
What's that like? Because, you know, people use that word, don't they? And it covers an awful lot. What was your breakdown? What was it like?
How it started for me, Ray, was I finished the cycle and come back, and like there was 5,000 people waiting in Ennis at the finish line. You know, it was a huge experience, and I'd met my now wife on the last day, and you know, I was back in Canada, back in lectures, and I just found it overwhelming, where I'd stopped going to lectures, then I didn't want to leave the house, then I couldn't leave my room for days, and it got to the point where one night I just went walking. And when I say a breakdown, this was the night I just realised. I walked for hours, and eventually a bus was coming down the street, and I just said to myself, would it just be easier to step in front of that bus? And, you know, it's hard to say that, because I know there's a lot of people listening that wouldn't know that, but I that gave me a fright. I rang my sister, and kind of that was the recovery, I suppose, from there.
Right. And Jim Stein, an inspiration, and he set up Reach, the Reach Foundation in Australia. And it was about giving young people the tools to cope with life. Resilience.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So it was sort of preventative rather than treating mental health when it happened, to get in there early and give them the tools to cope.
completely and to thrive. Like when I saw that documentary, Every Heart Beats True, there's a snippet in it where Jim's standing in the middle of this room and his head is just covered. You might remember it in scars, and there's teenagers all around him and people in their 20s, and they're each stepping forward and telling him how he had impacted their lives. And I was coming off the back. I was getting strong. I was getting mentally strong again. I was back playing hurling. And I was thinking, I can't be the only one. And then I talked to people and realized I wasn't. And this is like around the time of the global financial crisis. And whatever it was in that documentary, it just spoke to me. And I investigated Reach. And then two of us just went down, Jim was dying at the time, and said, we need to bring this back to Ireland, because it was very, very different to anything that existed at the time. Because, as you say rightly, it didn't wait for the problems to surface. It said, let's equip these young people with the tools to really navigate and have great lives.
Yeah.
And that's what Reach did, and that's what SOAR does.
Yeah, and SOAR has been doing that for how many years now?
Well, it's 10 years. And actually, the last time I met you, you may not remember this.
No, I do. I do. Vodafone. Yeah. I do.
Yeah. You grilled me, and I was delighted because right. I had kind of funded everything up to that point with the little savings I had. And I had sold my own car to get it going. But that day, the Vodafone World of Difference meant I could focus on it for a year and they would support you. So I was grateful to you and to the panel. So then for the next 9 years, we just traveled school to school. I met, worked, talked, listened to probably 40 to 50,000 teenagers over that time and learned so much from them.
And this book is the product of that, your experience and your conversations with teenagers, and most of all, I suppose, you're listening to teenagers.
Yeah, conversation is a great way to describe it, because the motivation for the book was really to create connection. And it's interesting because I had no intention to write the book. You know, I actually had 15,000 words of another book written, but my wife and I had a baby boy last May in the middle of lockdown, and he was colicky. So one evening I was driving him up, I drove every road in around Wicklow Mountains trying to get him to sleep. Any parent listening will know how that feels. But a friend of mine asked me for a quote for teenagers, and I really hate being asked for that, because they get enough adults telling them what to do or how to do it and talking at them. But this quote just came to me, Ray, and it's actually the way the book starts, and it's the most important relationship you'll ever have is with yourself. Every other is secondary. And it was over 9 weeks then, the book just tumbled out, and 9 weeks later it was sitting on the table in front of me. And it's written for teenagers, having met so many. I kind of had this realization going in and out to schools that I remember this one girl in the Midlands, and her friend had died by suicide, a boy. And she came up to me, she said, our class needs to talk about something, halfway through the workshop. And I said, go on. She said, we need to talk about him, and the adults don't want us to. So workshop starts, second half, and she said, put your hand up. She goes, can we talk about him now? Whatever your name is, she said, you know, real like gutsy. And I said, why do you think the adults don't want to talk about this? And she said, I'll never forget it, because they're afraid. And that is something I learned firsthand, is teenagers often want to maybe talk, but they don't necessarily know how to. And it's hard to talk to teenagers. Anyone that has one will know that.
Yeah.
So I didn't plan to write a book, but the book just kind of wrote itself, because I learned there's a lot of things teenagers need to hear at that stage of life. And parents and teachers are trying to, but somehow the teenager doesn't hear it. So I said, what if I put that in a book for them and wrote it in a way that I know they'll engage with?
Right.
And that's where it came from.
And you cover a lot of the themes. For example, even like we spoke to Edith Eger a couple of weeks ago, and she has The Gift, and it's her 12, you know, steps to get through life, or 12 bits of advice. And a lot of the same themes come up in your book, but you have repackaged, for the want of a better phrase, them for a teenage audience. And you use bad language, and you slag off parents, and you do all that. It's very difficult being a teenager, and I that even sounds patronizing itself, but it is very difficult being a teenager now with everything. And what about fear, and what about, you know, getting your identity when you're surrounded by social media? What about and all the temptations and all the you know, trying to look a certain way because everybody else looks that way on Instagram or whatever?
Yeah.
And the list goes on and on and on.
Yeah, I think every decade in all our lives presents its own challenges. It just happens at that age group, in that decade, there are so many happening simultaneously. You know, you have the physical and the mental and the emotional, but you're also not an adult, but you're not a child. So you're in this kind of limbo area. And you're so right, like one of the biggest things that used to come up in the workshops, and when you listen to 40, 50,000 young people talking really honestly, you learn a lot. I did. And one of the things were they compare themselves so much to what they see online and they think that's real life. And they're obviously always afraid of being judged. So I wanted to write it in such a way that it spoke to them and kind of grabbed their attention. And wrote about the things that came up again and again in school workshops, because it's really interesting. They used to say to me, speak, and I'd say, would you talk to your parents like this? And they'd say, ah, never. And I'd say, but why not? Mm. Well, they wouldn't understand. And I'd say, well, they were a teenager too, you know. But then on the other side, I'd have teenagers or parents who are really well-intentioned, good people, you know, ringing me saying, I can't get through to him, or, you know, I just wish they'd listen. So I was like, you know, that Stretch Armstrong guy with an arm being pulled in either direction. And a really surprising response to the book has been parents are reading it when they give it to their teenagers. They're flicking through and they're reading it. And then what's happening is, and this is unexpected, is it's becoming something that connects both. You know, they're usually on different levels. Yeah. But for the time they're discussing fear or death or why parents are idiots, they're on the same level and they're having a conversation. One mother said to me, my 13-year-old just stopped talking to me. You know, we used to have a hug, we used to have a lovely relationship, and he stopped. And we've started talking about the book as a way to kind of reconnect and get to know each other again.
Yeah.
And that's rewarding to hear, because that's unexpected for me.
And the way you communicate that as teenagers, and we've all been through this, we tend to take ourselves too seriously, don't we? Mm. Because I suppose that's the it's all about, you know, going from childhood into adulthood and trying to be act mature and trying to be earnest and all that sort of thing. And you impress throughout the book, like, have a laugh, be self-deprecating. And how do teenagers react when you say that to them?
Well, like, I think the first year I was going in doing workshops, like, I really floundered. Like, one day I almost just said, like, look, how do I talk to you guys? And they kind of gave me an education of how to do it. And one of the ways was they love when they see someone who's themselves, because that's what they're searching for. Like, in that age category, they're... identity isn't formed yet. So they're like trying on. That's why friends are so important, because with friends they trust, they can try on different identities in a way maybe they would feel judged by their parents. And they kind of find out who they are in that way. So the book, I encourage them in as many ways as possible, like, be your own unique flavor of weird, because that's what's going to attract your best mate for life or the partner that you can be yourself with. But that's why I also say in the book, like, look, I'm no expert. I don't have teenagers. But I hear you, and I know sometimes you feel unheard. So I just want to tell you, I see you, and remind them over and over again.
It's interesting, one of the things you said there, because it is that at that stage in our lives, that's where we form ourselves, you know, ourself. We form our identity. And as you described, that's the way it used to be, that you would try out various versions of yourself with your friends and you get a reaction and you find out what fits and what you feel comfortable with. Unfortunately now, there's a virtual self that we have to contend with as well. When I say we, I mean teenagers have to. And how do you advise people around that?
Well, it's difficult. Like, you know, it's hard to be a teenager now. It's equally as hard to be a parent of teenagers. Like, Ray, I have so many, don't know how they get it, but they get in contact with me and they say, what do I do with, you know, how do I tap into my son or daughter? And perhaps I'm hoping from what I'm seeing, the book can be that for some people, you know, it might just bring them together. But it's teenagers are able for much more than we give them credit for. That's why I don't sugarcoat it in the book. That's why when I used to run the workshops, I talk about the breakdown just to show them, this is me, like, look straight through me, I'm transparent. And that would engage them, because what they're looking for most at that stage is real. They want something to be real in their lives, and they're searching for that and honesty and truth. But they are able for more than maybe a lot of parents realize. So the book could help them, the parent, have a conversation which is a lot more honest, because the teenager is waiting for it.
You open the book with a love letter to teenagers. I'm doing this because I love you and because I feel you're completely undervalued by the majority of adults. you're trying to ingratiate yourself into their
win favour.
Yeah, win favour. As adults, yeah, we forget what it was like to be a teenager and how much wisdom we carried at that time of our lives. Because adults have forgotten that wisdom and instead acquired a lot of knowledge, much of it useless, they do not see you for who what you are. I want you to know that I do. So there you go. The tiger and the goat. The goat and the tiger. Would you just tell us that and how it helps? And this is something that we could all take away from the book.
Yeah, that actually happened. I visited an old couple in Northern California, Hal and Sidra Stone. Hal died last year in 19. They dedicated their life as a couple, 50 years of exploring identity. And they told me this story, which basically a tiger is giving birth and she dies in giving birth. And the little cub is raised by a group of goats, a pack of goats that the tiger was chasing when she died, right? So this tiger cub is raised as a goat, smells like a goat, eats like a goat, until one day a big tough male tiger comes, kills one of the goats, and then stops and sees this young tiger cub and can't believe it because it bleats like a goat. It looks like it's trying to be a goat. And he pulls him up, brings him over, brings him to a pond to look in the water. And the goat doesn't change. It's a tiger. Anyways, he feeds him the meat that he's just killed. And eventually the tiger takes a bite and then roars and the two tigers escape into the jungle. Now, when they told me that story, I hadn't a clue what it meant. But what they explained to me was, I said, I travel across the world and this is all you give me. A story about a tiger who thinks it's a goat. Their point was, inside all of us is someone that maybe we don't even know exists. We're much more than perhaps the goats we've become to believe we are. And inside us, we have the beating heart of a tiger. And the journey of life is to discover that. That's why the book starts with that, because it's almost like an invitation to young people to discover who they are, because that's what the adventure of life is really about. Yeah. And to discover that you're the tiger that thinks it's a goat. No offence to goats.
Yeah, I was just saying, much maligned goat. I still have two or three goat jokes there from yesterday. So you cover everything. You cover love, death, hard times, pain, friends, feelings, emotions, all of those things. And as I say, you package it in a way that I think will communicate to teenagers. And David got his son Killian to read the book and do a review of it. And you'll be delighted to hear that got a brilliant review from 15-year-old Killian. The so there you go.
If I could, Ray, one thing on it, because parents, they may decide to get it for their son or daughter. What I would urge them to do is don't hand them it and say, read it. Just leave it around the kitchen, because I guarantee you what's going to happen is the first day they might not read it, but the second or third, like Killian, that young guy, they'll pick it up. And once they do, my hunch is they're going to keep going. And then it's going to potentially create conversation in the house. Yeah. And then who knows what might happen.
And it's difficult normal times for teenagers, but particularly difficult now because they're missing all their mates. And my heart goes out to all of them. I don't know what we can do. But
it's a tough time. Yeah. And when you said I wrote that to ingratiate, I hate to disagree with you because I actually really admire you. But I actually wrote it because I saw so many teenagers that were doing amazing jobs, sometimes getting their mum or dad out of bed, getting their brothers and sisters to school and then going into school. I just met so many incredible young people that it's a heartfelt, genuine message to them that, like, you are wiser than you think, and just continue to find out who you are and believe in yourself. And to all the parents, maybe they'll find something in it together, and maybe there's something in it for both of them.
Tony, great talking to you. The Teenager's Book of Life is in bookshops now. Tony Griffin is the author. Mind yourself, Tony. Stay safe.
Thanks, Ray.
Bye, bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Tweet at Radio Ray RTE. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Anish Darcy now on the Free Skelton and Noel Tula, Maura de Wallish. Grandma, good morning. Thank you very much. 51551 or ray@rt.ie. When Tony cycled into Ennis that day, he had a child from every national school in Clare accompanying him. My son Dermot was picked to represent Cushing National School. I still remember that day. Weather was lovely. He's in Sydney now, says Marion. That's her son, Dermot. And on the chimneys, just do the necessary work to keep the chimneys standing safely. They don't need to be repurposed. What's wrong with them just being an architectural sculpture, says Elaine. And somebody else says, a listener says, somebody rang in to say there's a pair of falcons with a nest and two chicks on one of the towers, chimneys, the one nearest the water. They're quite rare in Ireland and they only have two chicks at a time. There are bird watchers that come down at the weekend to see them. And on a million, Michael's been on, says, as a student working in a pea factory in Peterborough in the UK, I volunteered to do a number of consecutive shifts in order to judge for myself how much is a million. I worked at the end of the production line where there was a counter to show how many cans passed. I fell off the stool sometimes during the night trying to stay awake. I never found out how long it took, says Michael. Ah, come on, Michael. You can't start a story like that and not have a good ending. Anyway, I want to see what a million looks like. Yes, I'll work forever just to see what a million looks like. It's our quiz of today. Great prize this week, courtesy of Electric Ireland, who are launching their new smart meter price plans, helping you manage your electricity usage for the better. And that means no more estimated bills or submitting your meter reading. You can search Electric Ireland smart meters to find out more. And thanks to Electric Ireland, whoever wins today will get themselves a 50-inch HD smart TV. Liz Hayden in Blessington, it could be you. How are you doing, Liz?
Hi, Ray. How's it going?
Good. And yourself?
Not a bother.
You're looking out at your husband building a house for you.
Well, he's not physically building it at the moment. He's slabbing some ceilings down there at the moment.
Right. Well, that's part of it, isn't it?
Yeah, all part of it.
All part of it, yeah. So give us the story of the house and your husband and you and your life together.
Yeah. I'm married to Stephen. We've got one little boy called Dara. He's a carpenter by trade and I'm a nurse. I'm working in the Mater Hospital. So hello to all the gang there in special care unit up on level 5 on St. Rayfield's ward in the Mater. And yeah, the house is going on probably definitely the guts of a year, but I suppose in the pipeline the last 4 years.
Okay.
It's taken this long to get it off the ground and get it up and running.
And you're building it from scratch, which is...
Yeah, so yeah. Direct labour, so yeah.
And is he the project manager on it?
Oh, he is.
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
and that's working out okay, is it, for you?
Working out okay, yeah. Got a lot of help, I suppose, from family as well, advising us and giving us a help out. So, yeah, but he, to be fair to him, he's done a huge amount of work down there.
Right.
Yeah.
And you're on the front line?
I sure am, yeah. So we've had... Some rough days in there. We were COVID positive on the ward I'm working on. First lockdown and then the second. So, it's been tough, but with great teamwork in there and all working together to keep people going and keep families
and
informed.
Have you been vaccinated, Liz?
We have, I have. I've had my two vaccinations.
Great.
Yeah, then we had the Pfizer one inside in work. So
okay. And is there a sense that we're out the other side at all? Because you're on the front line.
I suppose numbers in the hospital are way down.
Yeah.
And we're kind of being updated on a weekly basis on those numbers. Numbers in ICU, as far as I'm aware, are down as well, which is great. And obviously our ward has gone back to a regular medical ward now again. So that in itself is good news.
Yeah, it's a good sign. So yes, that's a good sign, yeah.
It's positive, definitely.
Yeah, yeah. And did you get it yourself?
No. Thankfully, no.
Right, okay.
No, thankfully, no. Managed to escape it, but a lot of my colleagues would have had got it and had got very unwell.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are still not right, you know, so
COVID, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, young, fit, healthy people.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Okay, you're up against...
no barriers.
No, it doesn't. You're up against Karen O'Sullivan from Bishopstown in County Cork. How are you doing, Karen?
I'm great, Ray. How are you?
Good. Now they're building a house and you're cleaning out the saucepan press.
I started on the saucepan and I've moved on and I wish I hadn't even started any of it because the kitchen is just worse than when it...
Okay.
Even started.
So is the saucepan press, is that organised? It is.
Kind of, yeah. I'm trying to put them in, stack on top of each other, but they only last around a day and then they all get mixed up again.
Of course they do, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And what are you moving on to next? Is it the crockery?
I'm going on to the glasses and the mugs and then the cutlery.
Then the cutlery, yes, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And what about the food presses? Are you going to tackle them?
No, not today, definitely. No. There's so much in there now, that's a full day on its own.
Is it? Yes, yeah. But you've started. That's the big thing. I bet you've been putting this off for a long time, have you?
I have. I just think in lockdown, I don't know, things just get thrown into cupboards and
there's
so much stuff bought.
Okay. Yeah. This is, I'm looking at stats here on you And this is, I suppose, you know, it's this is because we're reaching the anniversary of the first lockdown, and you will be celebrating your second birthday in lockdown this Friday.
I was the big 5-0 last year on the first day of lockdown. So on the 12th of March last year, so I spent about 4 hours queuing in Dunn's with my mother for food.
Right.
On my 50th birthday. So this year I'm going to celebrate doubly and make a big one of it, because I'm not going to Dunn's this year, that's for sure.
Yeah, but that's mad though, isn't it? Because
isn't it?
When you were probably saying last year, this is a big one. We can't do it right this year, but we'll definitely do it next year.
I know. Do we ever think this day last year we'd be heading into what we were and we'd still be here?
Yeah, no, we didn't.
Later, you know?
No, we didn't. Yeah. No, sure. We thought we'd be out of it by Easter, and then we thought we'd be
absolutely
out of it by summer.
Yeah. Look, once we all can stay healthy and everyone is safe.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So it's Liz versus Karen. 5 questions each. Whoever answers most correctly gets the big telly. And if we have a draw at the end of the 5 questions, we go to a tiebreak situation. Good luck, Liz. Good luck, Karen. Here we go. Right, Liz, first question for you. On this day in 1915, the British Army captured Neuve-Chapelle in Belgium. What's the capital city of Belgium, is the question.
Brussels.
Is the correct answer. Karen, on this day in 1964, Nina Cherry, Swedish singer-songwriter, was born in Sweden. What's the capital city of Sweden?
It's Stockholm.
It is. Right, Liz, second question for you is an audio one. Have a listen to this.
You see, on Thursdays, I'm sort of lost around here.
What's on Thursday?
It's the cruise night off.
You mean we're alone on the boat?
Completely.
You know, I've never been completely alone with a man before in the middle of the night, in the middle of the ocean.
On this day in 1960, at the 17 Golden Globes, that actress won the Best Actress Award for a role in Some Like It Hot. Can you name her?
No idea.
No idea?
No.
Which means you haven't seen Some Like It Hot?
No.
Liz, treat yourself this weekend and watch it. It's one of the best comedies ever made, and that was Marilyn Monroe with Tony Curtis there. In that clip you heard. Okay.
Iconic woman.
Yeah, indeed. Karen, yours is an audio one as well. Have a listen to this.
Que sera, sera. Whatever will be. The future's not ours to see. Que sera, sera.
So still with the 17 Golden Globes on this day in 1960, that actress was nominated for a Best Actress Award for her role in Pillow Talk. Can you name her?
Is it Doris Day?
It is Doris Day. It is. Well done. Okay, Liz, third question for you. On this day in 2006, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter arrived at Mars. How long does it take Mars to orbit the Sun? Is it 687 days or 1374 days?
687.
Is the correct answer. Well done. Karen, similar question for you. On this day in 1977, the rings of Uranus were discovered. How long does it take Uranus to orbit the Sun? 42 years or 84 years?
84 years?
Is the correct answer. Does it make me a bad person that I want to laugh when I say Uranus? I'm sorry. I know, it's juvenile, it's puerile, but there you go, it gets me every time. Okay, Liz, you're on 2, Karen, you're on 3. Liz, your 4th question is this.
People writing songs that voices never shared. No one dared disturb the sound of silence.
On this day in 1964, that duo recorded the first version of that song, The Sound of Silence, at Columbia Studio in New York City. Can you name them?
No.
Yeah, they're a bit before your time, these are, aren't you? I guess, they're a duo. No.
I've no idea.
No idea.
Sorry.
Simon and Garfunkel.
Okay.
Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel. Okay, now, Karen, if you get this one right, Liz can't catch you. It's an audio one as well. Have a listen to this.
So come on, see the light on your face. Let it shine, just let it shine. Let it shine.
And this day in 2007, that band were at number one with the song Shine. Can you name the band?
I can, Take That.
Yeah, there you go.
Love them.
Liz, they didn't suit you today.
They didn't suit me.
Hard
luck, Liz.
Yeah, yeah.
No worries.
Hard luck, Liz. We'll send you out 2 mugs.
Great stuff.
Okay, one for you and one for the hubby. What's his name again? Stephen.
Stephen.
Yeah, one for you and one for Stephen. And you can give them pride of place in the new house when
we
you move
indeed.
Into it.
We will indeed, right, yeah.
Will you be in before the end of the year?
Oh, hopefully, yeah.
Oh, great, great.
Time, hopefully.
Okay, good luck with that. Thanks, Liz. Mind yourself.
Thanks,
see you. Bye, bye, bye. Karen O'Sullivan, well done.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, Ray.
Yeah, there is a 50-inch HD smart TV on its way to you, courtesy of Electric
Brilliant.
Ireland.
That's a nice birthday present now to start
yeah,
the celebration.
Yeah, that's good, isn't it? Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
And thanks happy birthday
million,
as well. Have a great
Thank
day.
You.
See you now.
I
bye,
will.
Bye,
million,
bye, bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Firefly Lane has been a huge hit on Netflix. Kristen Hanna, who wrote the book which the series is based on, is going to be talking to us about her new book after this. John Armour Trading and Drop the Pilot, type of song you might hear, on Firefly Lane, which is on Netflix at the moment. It was number one there for a few weeks, and it's based on a book by our next guest, Kristen Hanna, who has a new book out called The Four Winds, which is set during the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl. Good afternoon, Kristen.
Good afternoon. It's nice to be here.
You're coming in loudly and clearly. From which part of the United States of America?
Great. I'm coming to you from California.
Wow. What's it like over there today?
You know, it's like it always is in California. Bright blue skies and sunshine.
Well, you'd be delighted to hear, as I was just saying there, that Firefly Lane is doing really well this side of the Atlantic on Netflix. So that's great news. And congratulations on The Four Winds. So this is a historical fiction. Now, you've written over 20 books, a mixture of contemporary and historical.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. So tell us about this. Tell us about The Four Winds.
Well, The Four Winds is a novel about a woman fighting for survival and fighting to save her children during the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl in the 1930s in America.
Will you tell people who wouldn't know about the Dust Bowl what it was?
You know, actually, I didn't know much about it when I started researching it. It was a period during the Great Depression, a four-year period, where on the Great Plains, which is Texas, Oklahoma, that area, the center of the country, a terrible drought started. And then because of some farming methods, in addition to the drought, the windstorms came and just like, you know, sent dust spiraling.
Uh-huh.
Dust that was picked up in Texas was dropped all the way on the coast on Washington, D.C.
So it was a tough time. And the protagonist is Elsa. And then she has a daughter called Lorida. And it's sort of, in reading about you, there's a bit of, you know, it's not obviously autobiographical in any sort of way, but Elsa dies young, and Lorida sort of lives her dreams, if you like, by ending up going to college. Is that a spoiler? Have I just ruined the whole thing?
Kind of.
Yeah. I was in the middle of it, and I was thinking, is this a spoiler? Is this a...
Yeah, you know, it's a novel about, I guess, motherhood and the relationship between these two and the dreams we have for our children.
Yeah. And your mum died young, didn't she, in her 40s?
Yeah, she did.
Yeah. And ye had started writing together as a mother and daughter team, had you?
Yes, we did. We started when I was very young, when I was 24 in law school, you know, when we sort of got started. She knew me so well, and she, I think, saw my future before I did.
Yeah, because it was sort of prophetic. She said, you know, you will be a writer.
Yes, yes, she did. And as usual, she turned out to be right.
Yeah. So at what stage did you turn your back on a law career and decide this writing was going to be a full-time thing?
Well, I really began writing in earnest when I was pregnant with my son, and I had a difficult pregnancy, and so I was bedridden for 7 months, and that's when I really started the first book. And I decided during that time period that I would really like to stay home with my son and be an at-home mom for several years, and I was lucky enough to be able to do that. And so I gave myself 5 years until kindergarten to to sell a book, and then it would be a job instead of just a hobby. And I did. I sold my first book when my son was two.
And you didn't do the normal stuff like, you know, writing short stories and or maybe writing the odd article for a local paper. You went straight for the novel.
I did, you know, which was really just, I guess, a combination of bold and naive and uninformed.
Well, that's often a good thing, isn't it? Because if we know the obstacles that are possibly there, we say, ah, no, we won't do that. I won't do that.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, it's my belief that, you know, the only way really to become a novelist is to write novels. And so to keep doing it, whether they sell or not.
Yeah, it's sort of a truism. You're the first person I read an interview there that you describe a sort of nearly an addiction to writing. It's like some people have an addiction to running or going to the gym or whatever. And you say that if you don't write for a couple of days, you get a bit antsy.
I do, which has kind of, you know, made the pandemic a doubly difficult time for me, because I, like a lot of people, have had trouble focusing and releasing my imagination and being, you know, as dedicated as I usually am. But I think writing is how I handle stress as much as anything else.
Now, Four Winds is a historical fiction. Firefly Lane, contemporary, well, it was over three sort of decades, I suppose. Was it the 70s, the 80s, and the sort of contemporary? I read that a lot of that stuff is borrowed from your own experience. Which bits exactly?
Well, Firefly Lane is very much, it's not autobiographical, but it's very much drawn from my life, my era, my, you know, the music I was listening to, the jobs I wanted to do, the issues that presented themselves to me. There's a breast cancer element in it, which was me at my mother's life, you know.
And would you be more Kate or more Tully?
Oh, I'm more Kate.
Oh, you're more Kate. Right. Okay. Right. That's in coloring or in behavior?
Just in everything.
Just in everything. Right. Right.
Yeah.
Patricia has been on from Castlebar in County Mayo. She says, I've finished Kristen's new book, The Four Winds. Wonderful book. Would love to see it made into a movie. Speaking of movies, your book, The Nightingale, is that in production at the moment?
It was in production until, you know, the pandemic shut it down.
Yeah. Shelley says, great book, Four Winds. Thank you, Kristen. All your books are great. You've a lot of fans in Ireland. So I'm looking at the book here, but you're obviously on the next one or the one after that, are you?
Well, I should be on the next one. But like I said, I've been having a little trouble.
Oh, right. Right. Would you call it writer's block, or am I allowed to say those words?
You know, I've never said those words in 30 years, so I'm not going to say them now.
That's okay. No, it'll be fine. It says he. I've only met you 10 minutes ago, but it'll be fine. But are you under pressure? Do you have a deadline, Kristen, now for the next book?
You know, I was under pressure for a lot of years, but I don't feel much pressure anymore. I think now I'm in a place where I, you know, obviously I want to, you know, hit deadlines. I want to be exactly as productive as I always have been. But I have a little more freedom now to explore stories. And, you know, as you know, The Four Winds is a very big, epic story.
It's a big story. It's a big story. Yeah. I'm wondering, is there an Irish connection? Because I see the word Cara. You use the word Cara in the book, C-A-R-A.
Yes. And Kate's name is Kate Malarkey. And that was my grandmother's name.
Aha.
So, yes, we are Irish. And in fact, we went on a family trip there 2 years ago, which was just magical.
Because you know, malarkey is a word, you know, all that malarkey.
Yes.
Yes. With reference to sort of bit of madness, a bit of, you know, diversion, all that malarkey.
That may match my grandmother. I'm not sure.
Right. And I think the malarkeys were, where are your ancestors from, did you say?
I think County Cork.
Cork. Yeah. I think that a lot of the malarkeys came from Clare, if my memory serves me correctly. Cara is, as you know, friend in Irish. You know that. Yes, yeah, yeah. I just spotted that. It's amazing how the brain works. You know, when you're flicking through a book and then you see a word, because it stood out because it's an Irish word. So there you go. More reviews in. Just finished Four Winds. Excellent read, says Deirdre. So what about fans of Firefly Lane? Will there be a second series, do you think?
Gosh, we are on pins and needles right now waiting to hear. Netflix is supposed to decide any day now. It performed exceptionally well.
Yes.
And people really seem to love it. I know I loved it. So I'm hopeful that we find out this week that there's a second season.
Okay. Well, drop us an email and let us know so we can be the first to tell your fans over here.
I would love to.
Yeah. Kristen, Hannah, thank you very much. Congratulations again on The Four Winds. It's in bookshops now. Mind yourself and stay safe. That's it from us. Cormac and Sarah are on the way. We are back tomorrow. Thursday at 3 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Wednesday evening.
It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.